And you're looking at a village that you just saw as our photographer was pulling out. That's a village, a ski resort, really, where it's magnificent, by the way. It's in the Caucasus Mountains, and it's one of the most beautiful and spectacular sights that I have ever seen. In fact, if it wasn't for the clouds, you'd be able to see these enormous mountain range behind me, which is just a sight to behold, which is what makes this place so perfect for this event. It's really a meeting of, I guess the best way to describe it would be intellectuals from all over the world. And I use that term loosely because there's diplomats here, there are academics here, there are journalists here, there are heads of state here, and they do this annually where people gather to try and figure out the direction of the world, really. And it's particularly important right now based on this transformational moment we're living through when we're going from what a lot of people, not all, but what a lot of people would call a hegemonic environment, you know, a hegemony, essentially, where it's unipolar, where one country or one set of countries kind of make the decisions for the rest of the world, to a multipolar world where suddenly countries like South Africa and India and China and Russia and many of the countries, Iran and other countries from the Middle East, for example, are suddenly asserting themselves. And let me not leave out Brazil, by the way. So that's what's going on here. It's trying to figure out what direction this multipolar world will actually take place. How will the BRICS community assert itself? How will the Global South community assert itself? And that's essentially what they're having here. They've asked me to be a part of it, and I have been absolutely enthralled with the experience thus far. And today it went in a kind of a different direction. Let me sit down so I can take you through what we're gonna be talking about here. Because today we had somebody who is admired very much so in the Global South community. Sergei Lavrov is the foreign minister from Russia, and he came here today, and we had a chance to sit down with him. He talked with us for about an hour and a half of how he sees things. By the way, he shared something which I thought was really fascinating. I'd never heard this story before, but he spoke specifically about what happened when he and Mr. Putin arrived in Alaska. And aside from the CCCP sweater that he also talked about, by the way, and joked about, he describes a moment where both sides became really close to coming up with a solution to the Ukrainian conflict. And he says that when Mr. Trump offered Mr. Putin the deal vis-a-vis through the Europeans and through Mr. Zelensky, Mr. Putin rebuffed it and said, no, 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 no. And then he came back and Mr. Putin said, according to Mr. Lavrov, he said, well, you know what, let me think about that. And maybe I'll consider it. Mr. Putin then comes back and says, you know what, I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to do this right now and sign this deal, or essentially come to some kind of understanding on this deal. And this is the only condition, apparently, that according to Mr. Lavrov, Mr. Putin made. The condition that Mr. Lavrov put on the table was the following. We have to remove the Ukrainian troops out of the area that's left of the Donbas, since we're already talking about those territories anyway. And as soon as they get those troops out of there, in other words, get those troops, the Ukrainian troops, out of there, and then we will, you know, in essence, as the Russians have often said, liberate the people who are still remaining in that area that's disputed in the Donbas. That's it. That's all we want. That's all we want. So Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Putin give that to Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump takes it back to the Ukrainian delegation, takes it back to the Europeans. And according to Mr. Lavrov, they never heard back. They never heard back. So I found that a fascinating story because it kind of makes a light bulb go off in terms of us being able to understand just how close these things sometimes can come and how far away they can end up being. So that's where they left that. There's something else that Mr. Lavrov spoke to, And I want to get to that in a minute, because I think that's an important part of the story as well. I'm going to be playing that for you in just a minute, but I wanted to remind you that we're doing From the Mountains today, the Sanchez effect. So let's continue on the other side of this. All right, so here's the other thing that I think is fascinating that Mr. Lavrov talked about, and I think this is a very important issue. He was asked about the situation with the EU and Gaza, and how the EU has promised some funding for the Palestinians, something to the tune of $1.5 billion. So what he does, interestingly enough, is he reminds people, comparatively speaking, of what the EU is promising the Palestinians and thumping its chest about, and what the EU and other Europeans have been giving to Ukraine to highlight the difference in the comportment. Here is the foreign minister of Russia, Mr. Sergei Lavrov.
Ursula von der Leyen said the EU will support Palestine, emphasizing the need for its reconstruction, and that the European Union is allocating 1.5 billion euros for this purpose, which she stated with pride as a substantial amount. But how much do they give to Ukraine? Not for its reconstruction, but to fight against Russia, it's hundreds of times more. Recently, Ukraine even approached the World Bank for a loan of, I believe, 38 billion, but the World Bank suggested 65 billion instead. This bias and abuse of multilateral mechanisms to promote one's unilateral, geopolitical, and selfish goals is a disaster. Additionally, the World Trade Organization also needs reforms, as the United States has been blocking the functioning of dispute resolution bodies for many decades.
You know, it's interesting to understand exactly what Mr. Lavrov's perspective is, because he was there, packed house, by the way. There are 40 countries represented here. And in that particular hall where Mr. Lavrov was speaking, there wasn't anything but standing room only, with a lot of people very interested in what he had to say. And of course, there were a lot of questions about what's going on right now, both in Ukraine as well as this 19 or 20 point deal that just came out of the United States regarding Palestine and Israel. So we're going to be drilling down on that. It's very important. It's a major point of discussion here. Although, and I should say this is important, it also becomes a point of contention for those here who are conflictively questioning whether this multipolar world or this BRICS association that is being bragged about in many ways here, because there is a lot of braggadocio about the whole, you know, multipolar world, whether it's really as effective as it's made out to be. And if it were really that effective, how come it can't do much about what's going on in Gaza? It's a good question that we're going to tackle in just a little bit. And I'm going to do that with several guests. The first one has already arrived. And of course, you know what they say about South Africans, they're never late to a party. So joining me now and good enough to join me is my good friend Kofi Kouakou. He is a senior researcher from the University of Johannesburg. He's an expert in both Africa and China relations. Professor, good to see you, my friend.
Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure. What did you make of Mr. Lavrov's comment about 1.5 million and they're thumping their chest for the assistance they're giving the Palestinians while they've given something to the tune of almost 100 billion to Ukraine?
Yeah, of course he has a point. I mean, there's so much to look into. The Gaza issue is just quite a disaster. I don't have to spell it out. But it hasn't been any strong strength to stop this disaster and this genocide. And I think his point is very important. And the reason why it's important is that this must stop. But again, if it has to stop, who's going to stop it?
You're president. You're president. Can I just give you some kudos? I'm going to give you some props. Ready?
Sure, yeah.
The only country in the world that I have seen that has actually stepped up, right, with intestinal fortitude is South Africa. Because with all due respect to Russia, with all due respect to India, with all due respect to China, certainly with no due respect to the Europeans who are late to the party, they just joined last week when they said we think Palestine should be a state. Well, duh. But your president has come forward and has gone to the United Nations and has pressed for actions by the United Nations, calling it what most people say it is, which is a genocide.
Yes, indeed. I think it's a really good way of doing it. I think South Africa is now has a very powerful moral up ground, which means South Africa is really up and in saying, in fact, it was the first nation to take Israel to the ICC. And the ICJ. And so doing that, that moral power has put South Africa up front, even in front of Russia or even China or any other nation. And now many nations are following up. But there's this gesture about putting it in court, but also being able to stop the genocide. And I think this is where the point comes in to see, why can't we stop it? We can talk all we want at the United Nations. South Africa can push as hard as it is, pushed, and other nations are pushing. But what is exposing is sort of the, I wouldn't say the lackadaisical ability to stop something that's happening, but international law today doesn't have the strength that it used to have in the past, because nobody can stop this genocide at this stage. And if they could stop it, when are they going to do that?
Were you at my seminar yesterday, the one that I moderated with China and Russia and Iran?
And
there were two outliers, right? Mm-hmm. There was Brazil and there was Turkey. And both Brazil and the Turkish representative as
Taha,
who's going to be joining us, by the way.
Yeah.
He said, look, you guys can, he did, these are my words, not his, but I'm going to paraphrase him.
Sure.
He basically was saying, we could sit here and thump our chests all we want and brag about multipolar, about this multipolar world that we're establishing, and it's so great, and it's going to be great for the future. But if it really is so great, and it's going to be so great for the future, why can't it solve the Gaza problem? Yeah. That's not a bad question.
No, it's a very good question. It's a, well, it's a bit of teasing out people, but it's a reality. If it's the BRICS are so great, why can't they stop this genocide or any other problems around the world? But you have to understand the BRICS are not a coherent, completely consolidated group yet. They're a very eclectic group of people with different ideologies. They don't have a military force. Which one's going to come? Is it China? Is it Russia that's going to send troops there? Is it South Africa? Is it anybody else? So the moral up ground is probably the only one they're looking at. They can just probably speak, and they want to do it in the way that respect the law, not to create more problems. However, this approach is so slow, it doesn't help in stopping the genocide in Gaza.
Shouldn't it be Egypt? Shouldn't it be the Gulf states? Shouldn't it be Jordan? Shouldn't it be Turkey? Shouldn't it be a regional gathering?
Of course it should, but
where are those countries?
Of course they're not doing anything, and this is what really puzzles many of us who are a little bit beyond, a little bit down south of Africa. And then those who are very close, Egypt, you know, the Arab countries. I mean, it's a tough question to ask. Why aren't they doing it? Is it because they don't have the armies, because they're weak, because they don't have the strength internationally?
This is why it's hard not to respect South Africa's position. South Africa is miles, hundreds of miles away from this conflict, and yet they're the ones who are sticking their neck out in this situation, taking on not just the Europeans, obviously, but they're somewhat weak.
And then, of course, for that, they're paying a price now with the U.S. sanctions. You know, South Africa has now got to top to about 30%.
Join the club.
So South Africa is paying a big price, and I think President Ramaphosa is doing all his best he can. I mean, he's got huge domestic issues to deal with, in addition to the Gaza, you know, genocide that he's brought forth in front of everybody. Most people wouldn't have even tried if South Africa hadn't laid down those sort of those complaints against Israel. Nothing would have happened.
What is What toll is he taking politically for doing this?
I think it's a huge toll, both domestically at home. Domestically at home, you have a lot of groups of Zionists who are really against him, trying to find ways to pin him down. Internationally, with the United States also, you have Zionists also in the U.S. who have been giving a hard time, as you know, in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah.
You know, across the board, there have been legislation, again, you know, looking into the relationship between, re-looking into the relationship between South Africa, no, the U.S. and South Africa. And he's really, you remember the meeting between him and President Bush, where South Africa has been accused of killing white people.
Yeah.
And that turned into some kind of very comical and theatrical meeting, but it was not quite a good thing to see on TV. So he managed not to escape that, but he came out of there really, if you want, with a sense that he didn't lose his dignity completely. However, he's still under pressure from the U.S., externally and also at home.
Before we move away too much from that topic, I probably should press you on this, because
sure.
the more I read about the situation in Johannesburg, the more depressed I become. Mm-hmm. The crime rate is very high. From an economic standpoint, things do not look good. At what point do, I suppose, the average South African says, look, Mr. President, I'm glad you're very concerned about the people of Gaza, but here's my concern, us. When are we going to get what we need? Why don't you start taking care of the domestic situation before you see yourself as this big international boo-ha-ha guy trying to make a lot of noise?
Yeah, I mean, it's been
saying... Are people saying that?
Yeah, no, people are saying that. Even many of us who've been listening to people sort of saying, okay, why don't you take care of your domestic issues? You have more problems at home. But in this dynamic world, you can't just do that. You can walk and chew the gum at the same time, which means, in fact, most of the things that are happening outside, if you remember President Nelson Mandela, former President Nelson Mandela.
Yes, of course.
He said, if the Palestinians are not free, we are not free. And is still, and as you know, his great son, Mandla Mandela, is now on the flotilla going to Gaza with a group of 50 of these boats. So there is a sense of, it's almost like a duty to really play that role externally. It doesn't mean that President Ramaphosa is forgetting what's happening at home. It's also tough at home. Crime rate is very high, that's for sure. Corruption is a problem. But, you know, I don't want to belittle it, but it's a huge global issue as well.
Yeah. Before we leave, let's talk about the continent in general, not just South Africa. Obviously,
sure.
South Africa is one of the biggest and most important countries in the continent. But there's a lot of noise being made these days about Niger and Burkina Faso and other places. We heard Mr. Lavrov comment on it today.
Yeah.
What is Russia's role? What is China's role in these places that are still in many ways either fighting colonialism or neocolonialism?
Yes, I asked that question to during one of those sessions. I mean, this has never been seen before, that three countries that are now run by military people who have taken over, and constitutionally, of course, but who are trying something new. And at the heart of their sort of demand and request and the question they're posing to everybody is to say, wait a minute, you know, we haven't been satisfied by the result of democracies around here. And if you do a complete audit of democracies in these places, they've been terrible across the board. Can we try a new system? And it's not a joke. I'm saying this like this, not a joke. So nobody wants, very few people want to give them a chance, especially Western countries,
yeah.
and especially France that used to run those places. And they're now asserting their sovereignty. And they're not doing it alone, because they can't do it alone. They don't have the arms, they don't have the resources, they don't have the clout. So they're now finding new partners. And the two new partners that they're finding, of course, are Russia and China. China on the soft side of the power, which means economic power, cultural stuff, and then Russia on the hard power, with military support, with the Wagner group before, and then now the Africa Corps. And as you've heard it, Minister Lavrov talked about how they've moved now. The Africa Corps is now helping the Malian military, as well as the Burkinabe and then the Niger military, to deal with the terrorists who, he said himself, were seemingly funded by France and some European countries, and then Ukraine as well.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Is the Africa Corps being accepted, generally speaking? I know you can't speak for every country or all the people of Africa.
Yes, if they were not expected help to be there, they wouldn't be there. They accept.
They kick them out.
Yeah, they'll kick them out because these three military rulers are very serious about their future. And we've never seen this kind of alliance before, and it seems like it is working. Obviously, people are looking from outside, are criticizing it, dismissing it as something that's not going to work.
And you're not just saying that because we're in Russia and you're afraid to insult the Russians that are here,
no,
right?
No. I'm not saying that.
China and Russia are essentially making inroads in a way that the colonial countries weren't able to do.
I've never done this before. Yeah. And this is really irritating the hell out of the French, especially President Macron, who is just very angry with the three leaders of these three countries, but also with Chad. And there seemed to be a movement that's slowly growing. People are now picking up and saying, look, we want our sovereignty. Let us try other system that work for us. Give us that room, and I think they're going to be able to succeed if they're left alone.
I mentioned to you Taha a little while ago, who was joining us yesterday in the seminar. Mm. He's just come into come into the mountain here. So he's going to be joining us in just a little bit, representing, of course, Turkey. Mm. And, of course, Radhika Desai is also going to be joining us. She's a professor of political science at the University of Manitoba. So we're going to have South Africa, Canada, and Turkey. That's going to be a pretty good combination. We're going to take a short break. Don't go away. The conversation continues on the other side. So this is the Sanchez effect once again. And, it really is kind of a meeting of the minds. A lot of very smart people. There are world leaders and there are ambassadors, people from the diplomatic corps. There are academics and there are journalists here. They gather once a year to discuss what is essentially, the plan globally for how things are turning out in all the different parts of the world. There's about 40 countries that are represented here. But this year, it's particularly important given what happens to be, I think it's safe to say, a transformational moment that's taking place. It's similar to the conversation that you and I had when we were chatting with each other when I was in the Shanghai Cooperative Summit as well, where we saw suddenly countries coming together. I would venture to say, and some would argue, forced to come together is different than just coming together. Forced to come together. And kind of showing off their wares with some pretty significant optics, as we saw in the Shanghai Cooperative Summit with Mr. Xi, Mr. Putin, and Mr. Modi almost doing some performance antics, making sure that the whole world was seeing just how much they like each other, which I thought was an interesting sight to behold, but effective, because all of a sudden we saw that headline and we saw those pictures all over the world. So this is almost in many ways a continuation of it, but now the question is being asked, and I mentioned to you just a little while ago that there was one person in particular at the symposium that I was moderating yesterday who raised that point and said, before we start thumping our chests and getting too excited about this whole multipolarity thing, maybe we should ask some real good questions to make sure it's verifiable and viable and really happening. And as I turn now, my guests have joined us. And here they are. Let me introduce to you Taha Ozan. He is a research director from the Ankara Institute. And he is, as I mentioned earlier, one of the speakers from Turkey who in this symposium yesterday, and it was what? It was India, China, Russia, and Brazil and Turkey. And there were two outliers. It was Brazil and Taha from Turkey were saying, before we get too excited about this, I want to raise some questions. And I'm going to let him do that in just a minute. But there always has to be someone who's beautiful and intelligent joining the group. So Radhika Desai is joining us. She's a professor of political science from the University of Manitoba, representing the great country of Canada. There you go. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks
as
for having
well.
Us.
So Taha, to you.
Yeah.
Go ahead and rearticulate, if you would, the point you were trying to make yesterday about maybe we got to hold on to our horses a little bit before we move too forward with this whole multipolarity thing.
Actually, I was trying to be explaining things at the very basic. I mean, as the multipolarity suggests, there should be multiple polars and there should be polars. When I check out what I see, we are not there yet. But the idea is shaping itself, it's real, and it's becoming more solid every year while the entire global geopolitical depression, which I call, is getting deeper and deeper. But for any kind of multipolarity to be different than having a bunch of different power centers, it needs a kind of software where the countries are having opportunity to talk each other and produce policies. Because having just a relationship or having an extensive relationship will not replace the policy itself. Policy means you have some shared vision, mm-hmm. you can have different sectors, can talk each other, work each other. Right now, we are not there.
Sounds like you're saying you're afraid that we're going to replace one hegemony with another. Yes. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, actually, my question at the very beginning of the presentation was this entire multipolarity debate right now is actually the question of what will come after this hegemony. So we are not clear on post-hegemonic order currently. Multipolarity may give some answers, but at the end of the day, these different polars in itself should be producing kind of rule-based approach, should be producing kind of value-based relationship and security. We are not there, but we can go there.
Radhika, what do you think? I'm hearing you moving nervously over there as you're listening to his words.
Well, I'm trying to think about exactly where I should begin, because I have a lot to say about this. I think maybe I should begin by saying that we're confusing two things. I think we are confusing the state of multipolarity, and we are already there, and I'll explain in a second. And the second thing, what we're confusing that with, is the ability of the various poles of the world system to work together, or at least the non-Western ones to work together. Now, these are, both of them are good questions. They should be asked, but they should also be separated. What do I mean by multipolarity? The world had already become multipolar in the late 19th century, once the dominance of Great Britain, as the who was in command of the the world market in the mid 19th century, was challenged by new industrializers. By that I mean the United States, I mean Germany, mm-hmm. I mean Japan, etc. So their rise, their industrialization by the early 20th century had already made the world multipolar. That also meant, speaking of hegemony, and this has been my argument in various books I've written, the United States was never hegemonic. The world had already become multipolar. And if it was not enough that there were the East Asia, Japan, etc., and Western Europe had already industrialized in competition with alongside the US, in competition with the UK, there was also the problematic fact that the Soviet Union emerged by the 1930s as the second industrial power in the world, which meant that by the post-war period, by the end of the Second World War, we were not talking about a unipolar world. It was a bipolar world. So that's why the two questions have to be separated.
But since 1991, it has been a hegemony led by the United States. Is there any way I could... Is that not true?
It's not true.
No?
Yes, it's not true. In the sense that, yes, everybody thought that the United States had won the Cold War and it was now going to give, there were going to be two effects. One was the world would be ruled by a benign multipolar leadership of the United States and the world would enjoy a peace dividend. What has happened instead is that the United States' economic power has declined. Mm. Already by the early 21st century, you had George Bush Jr. imposing steel and aluminium tariffs on China. By the 2010s, you had Obama doing his pivot to Asia. Mm. By the middle of the 2010s, Trump was elected and he was already going China, 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 China. Now, Biden continued that. Trump number two is continuing that. So we have that. Plus, the world never enjoyed a peace dividend. We have had unending war because the West, especially the United States, cannot accept that its dream of unipolarity, which seems so near after 1991, was not fulfilled.
The United States or Israel?
All of them. Well, okay. Israel, okay, that's a huge question.
Because you just said the United States couldn't afford peace, but...
The United States could not accept the fact that it was now living in a world where there were other substantial producers and the productive power was more widely spread and also could not... And therefore, it generated most of the military aggression and the Europeans have gone along with it on the whole.
By the way, don't wait for me to give you permission to speak on this. If you feel like you have something you want to say, please join. By the way, I just will say this, though. What I hear Taha saying is, let's be careful as we move forward
in this new multipolar world that we don't create another hegemony with a country like India that has all of these people and all of the service industry, or a country like China that has all this money and all this wonderful economy, or a country like Russia that has so many natural resources and so much military that any one of these decides they're going to Bigfoot the so-called multipolar world. Is that, in some measure, what you're worried about?
In a sense, it may arrive there, but the main issue right now is not that. Main issue, those countries, and you can add some other...
They're middle, big countries.
Yeah, middle powers, you can easily add them. Still, they were not able to produce and present and submit a kind of vision where we can operate differently than the current dysfunctional system. That's the main question for me. And this starts with the security issues. I mean, if they cannot provide security, a kind of peace, then the questions will continue to rise. For example, last night, His Excellency, Mr. Trump, came out, as he says, his beautiful so-called peace plan.
Yes.
I don't know when was the last time ending a genocide is called peace. There are no fighting sides in this war. Literally, a genocide is taking, one part is... massacring, the other part is trying to protect as much as they could.
And he's putting a person of peace like Tony Blair in there,
so it's got to work. The last time he involved such thing, it caused hundreds of thousands of people killed in Iraq.
Yeah.
So who is going to stop this? Or who is going to offer a different vision? Why those all powers waited last 2 years to offer an alternative vision as soon as he declared it, without, I mean... Any option, since they have, especially the Muslim countries, they needed to just approve it. So that's the actually, yes, a kind of way to reach the ceasefire, not the peace deal. But at the end of the day, it shows there are too many, kilometers that we need to go.
But I also wanted to say
the something. Only country that's actually done something objective is South Africa, by the way, just to give credit where credit is.
I think at least on a moral ground, South Africa has done something, but it's not sufficient enough.
Yeah.
Now, my understanding of multipolarity, and as I look at it at any system, there's no guarantee that because we're calling it multipolarity, there will be peace. Let me say it again. There's no guarantee that because there's a multipolarity, there will be peace. Most of these nations, in fact, some of them will love the status quo. In fact, they would probably want to play the role of the United States if possible. On the surface.
Which ones? Which ones do you suspect?
Both Russia
and China. But don't say Russia because you're in Russia.
Both Russia and China would love to have this strength. I mean, when you understand power, and I think the conversation yesterday probably didn't go deep enough because there was not enough time. On looking at the nature of power. Power doesn't give away easily. That includes the United States, that includes Russia, that includes China. When they all ask for a new structure for this global order, you see them, they're very coy. Even today, you know, Minister Lavrov was saying, okay, we're now waiting for Africans to get the act together and decide what they're going to agree on a collective, who they want to be on the United Nations Security Council. It's a bit vague to me, right? But he has a point to say, Africans must come forward, make something, make some proposals. This is how I would like to see the system. But they won't be able to do that because they don't have the power necessary to push for that change to happen.
Interesting.
So we need to examine the role of
power. There is an imbalance.
Power,
yeah, there's a power
which we
imbalance.
Haven't really discussed much.
But if I may just come in, I mean, I think Taha and you are both raising good points. However, one of the implications of multipolarity is that there is no world policeman. And also, we are living in a special stage of multipolarity in which the power of the West has declined, but nevertheless, the ability of the West to wreak a lot of damage is not gone away.
That's
and
right.
Remember, we live in a nuclear-armed world. Israel is a nuclear power.
Yeah.
It is not that easy to stop Israel. You know, once upon a time, a genocide was stopped by defeating Germany. At that time, there was no nuclear power. Germany did not have nuclear weapons. Today, the fact that North Korea has nuclear weapons means that the United States can't just walk in.
They're checked.
And exactly, they're checked. So that means that we're living in a very different world. Now, I agree that people should make an effort, and I think efforts are being made. The United Nations General Assembly has passed resolution after resolution calling for an end to this. So people are putting forward a different... China is putting forward a very different view of how the world should work. China is calling for an end to this genocide. Mm-hmm. But it is not as if China were to challenge Israel, which means it would challenge the United States, there would be nuclear war. Even more people would be killed than the 65,000 multiplied by 10... who have been killed. Because the official figure is 65,000, but there's good reasons to imagine that it's 10 times as many have been killed. Yes.
How does Erdogan balance his position, global position, as one of the most sought-after leaders in terms of his opinion of what's happening, everything from Asia through Eurasia, through the Middle East? How does he balance his position as a guy who's constantly bespeaking the atrocities of what's happening in Gaza vis-a-vis a leader who can actually make an actionable difference since he's a Middle Eastern leader who's also a European? He's in a unique place. Has he done enough? Maybe that's the way I should ask the question.
I mean, he himself says he wasn't able to done enough. Yeah. He said, I mean, we let our brothers in Gaza down, he himself says. And it's obvious over there what's happening. But the balancing is actually for him and for Turkey is not multi-front. He only needs to balance with Washington because most of the problems are coming out of there. And yesterday I said, when I said American problem combined with the Israel problem, it's a crisis and war in our region. This is different than the rest of the world. In Washington also, Trump asked him cut the relations, energy relations with Russia. Yeah, it's just a rhetoric. Maybe they are going to push, but it will not happen. And to make it, you need to act de facto. Rhetorical responses, yes. Rhetorical debates will not take you anywhere. You need to take the step. And that step is, no, I am not cutting. I have my energy interdependence and independence. Mm. Plus, we have all kinds of shared projects, which we paid hundreds of billions of dollars last 30 years.
Same as the Indians.
And it's not because just you're asking going to take place. So this is the policy, if you can do it, different than relations, which I'm trying to raise. And there is a policy between Moscow and Ankara on that thing, although in many fronts, they were thinking differently and acting differently, starting with Syria. And that problem is out of the picture right now. It's getting easier and easier to have kind of policy vision together.
And I just like to
reiterate... That's fascinating, by the way. I'm so glad you said that. Go ahead, Professor Desai.
No, and I just like to reiterate a point that Taha just made. We live in a turbulent world, but if you think about it, the bulk of the turbulence in the world is emanating from one epicenter, namely Washington, D.C., namely the United States. If you think of the war in Ukraine, if you think of the genocide in Gaza, it is Washington. And you have to understand this. I mean, while it often looks as though Netanyahu is out of control, and there is no doubt that there is an element of truth in that he's not even completely in control of Washington. All Washington has to do is stop sending them arms. Trump always professes these pious hopes. Oh, we should stop all this killing. Children are dying. Melania thinks children are dying. Well, I'm glad Melania thinks children are dying. They are dying. But you hold the key.
But they cannot do it. They are addicted to it. And
Did you say addicted?
Addicted to military spending. And it's not just a kind of addiction because of weakness. Yesterday also that issue came out. This is a very standard line. U.S. spent $1 trillion in Iraq, $2 trillion in Afghanistan. They could have done this and that with that money. No. It's not expenditure. It's actually investment. Hmm. This military industrial complex needs such a thing. It gives you two things. It helps you, which other countries rationally and ethically could not spend this much money. It helps your entire machine to run. Plus, at the same time, imagine a boxer, which is 150 kilogram, keep training, although he doesn't have any adversary. The nearest one can be, 60 kilogram boxer.
But do you think instinct... I'm sorry, you were going to say. Go ahead.
Well, again, I want to add to that, remember I said earlier that the unipolar moment didn't last. Right. Well, the underlying economic reason why unipolar moment did not last is because the United States was already embarked on an economic path, which was its path to ruin, which was this neoliberal economic policy, leading to financialization, leading to the weakening of the productive structures. And in this context, choosing to spend money on the military, which could easily be spent looking after problems at home, whether they're of infrastructure, inequality, poverty, a lack of a good healthcare system, et cetera. There's plenty of stuff. But the point is they choose not to do it because if they did that, it would empower ordinary people in the United States who would then make choices that would go against That's corporate right. power, which is the real power behind Washington
which
today.
Which brings us to the definition of we were talking about earlier, what is a thriving democracy? What is a democracy, period? If your democracy is based on a certain power base, i.e. the military-industrial structure, paying off every senator and every president and every cabinet member and every congressman and every congresswoman so they can get elected, so they can decide who or what decisions are going to be made on behalf of that country, that's not a damn democracy. You could say all you want, we got a democracy, but it's not a democracy if it's controlled totally by money. Am I wrong? Oh,
yeah, you have a point, or maybe it's a different type of democracy we can call it. I remember when the French, famous French, historian and observer at the United States wrote the book on democracy in America.
Yeah.
You know, these were the heydays of what they thought and they saw as democracy. But even then, they didn't even consider the majority of people because the elite still ruled.
The beacon on the hill.
Yeah. And it's still, the idea of democracy to a large degree at some times, we have the feeling that's an illusion that's been pushed forward all the time.
Well, I hear that in this conference all the time. Yeah. Everybody's arguing about, I know, it's a cloud that's coming through us right now. I mean, isn't that amazing? I don't know if you guys can see it at home. But if it's getting a little cloudy or a little dark, it's because we literally have just had a cloud move through while we're having this conversation.
We're in a real cloud.
Which is creepy, but really cool. But continue, I'm sorry.
Part of it works, but not all of it. And we're seeing all the evidence today in the United States, where you have the elites, especially sitting in Congress, who just don't care about anything that happens.
We're bought off.
So if they're bought off, by whom?
Well, but the American experiment is a wonderful experiment. It's a beautiful experiment. Our Constitution is magnificent. If you read it, it's so pure. It's so clean. What happened in the last...
So if you have a patron that's already bought all these congressmen, who is making the rules in Washington?
So number one, it's not just the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex is one of several... complexes. There's the military-industrial complex, there's the financial complex, or the fire sector, the finance, insurance, and real estate. There is the pharmaceutical sector, and there's one more, I forget which what it is.
Israel.
The media.
Well, the media is also there. But there's also the fossil fuel.
Yeah,
the fossil fuel. Oh, ICT.
Yeah,
and
ICT.
The fossil fuel sector. So these are the ones. And what you've got in America is the best democracy money can buy. That is to say, you have electoral laws and electoral finance laws, which basically allow... I actually show my students a graph, which show that every election since the 1960s has been won by the presidential candidate that has spent the most money. The exception was Trump in the first iteration. I don't know what happened in the last election. I have not checked. But certainly that was the case. So that's one thing I wanted to say. Second thing I want to say is that what happened? You said, what happened? It's such a beautiful constitution.
Yes.
Blah, blah. You know what happened?
No.
Real democracy happened. As Kofi was just saying, when Tocqueville wrote his Democracy in America, most people didn't have the franchise. Yeah. You had slavery.
Yeah.
And what has happened since is that ordinary Americans have got the franchise. And let me tell you one really interesting
fact. What do you mean by the franchise?
Franchise, the right to vote.
Ah, okay.
The right to vote. And let me tell you one really interesting thing. You can say, there are scholars who argue, and I'm with them, that you cannot say that the United States had universal adult franchise until the 1970s. Why? Because until the 1970s in the southern states,
Civil
you still
Act.
Had Jim Crow laws,
yeah.
which prevented non-white people from voting. And it's no wonder that since that time, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, you've had scandalous instances of people trying to prevent black people from voting, poor people from voting, etc.
So are you arguing it's gotten worse since the 1960s?
Absolutely.
How could making more people able to vote make the democracy less stable?
The more people you can have the right to vote mean you have to spend more and more money trying to make sure that they don't end up electing somebody who really represents their interests.
Mm.
QED. Yeah.
Wow. So the money has won over the
That's
power
it.
Of the
and
vote.
And for me, all of that, the conversation is going back to Taha. What does that mean for multipolarity? As the United States internally is fragmented and is also, as many speakers have said, is decaying
mm-hmm.
from the top power it has. What does that mean going forward? And there's a vacuum now which is showing up clearly. Who's going to fill it? It's going to be China. It's going to be Russia.
Do you trust? That's actually a great point that you just made, Kofi, because I'm wondering, and I've kind of tried to take a poll around here, asking people here, do you trust those countries more than you trust the old colonials, and why?
I think at this stage, we're giving them some credit. However, for many of us who have been studying the behavior of power in human beings, people may promise you to say, yeah, no, we have the grades. It's going to be a win-win solution. But as soon as they get the power, guess what happens?
I'll call you in the morning.
Exactly. They will change.
I mean, don't call me, I'll call you.
The psychology of global power, even power in general, tells us that. There's plenty of evidence. And so we can trust them now, but our trust must evolve, and we must be vigilant. And I would agree with her, we still must be suspicious until we continuously trust them and then prove the trust, or they prove that we can still trust them. It's going to be a tough one.
Well, Taha could talk to that because he's the man in the middle. I mean, Michael Jackson talked about the man in the mirror.
Yeah, yeah.
Turkey's like the man in the middle. They're a little Europe. They're a little Asia. They got a river that divides it right down the middle. Mm-hmm. They have associations with the United States. They get along great with China and Russia. I mean, you guys are like everybody's girlfriend in some ways.
not a good idea.
Don't take that the wrong way.
Not a good idea. Yeah.
So it's unique for you to be able to look at the world as it's developing and find your place for it.
I mean, this if it is a hedging strategy, it won't work in the midterm and long term. At the end of the day, I said yesterday, you need to settle somewhere, each country.
Yeah.
And no one can settle uniquely at the middle of mountain. You need to cooperate, you need to have relations, you need to have shared vision. Here I need to raise one important dynamic, which
Please.
Has not been even pronounced. We are in the Black Sea, and we are next to Europe, as Turkey and Russia. Actually, we are extension of Europe, or they are extension of us. I don't want to get into this post-colonial geography debate, but Europe is there, and Europe is changing. It will change more. Because they were in the setup of this Eurocentric, which is included.
Should I suggest not for the better? When you say it's changing, not for the better?
Actually, for the better in
long term.
Okay,
explain.
Yeah, because, I mean, they were living in the world philosophically, psychologically, culturally, in this Eurocentric Western understanding. But the more they see the American problem coming onto them, they need to look around, and they will have to interact more with their neighbors than the U.S. at the end of the day.
Hmm.
We'll see. In coming future, it will happen.
That's interesting, isn't it, Radhika, Professor, that Mr. Trump has alienated Russia, China, India, Europe, Latin America, all at the same time.
Well, you know, I think that understanding Trump, you know, a lot of people say understand. They try to find a method in his madness.
Mm-hmm.
There must be some reason for this strange tariff performance, this tariff tempest that he's, you know,
tantrum.
Wreaking around the world,
the
or you know, his alienation of Europe, etc. I think that actually one very solid way of understanding is you have to realize the deep political crisis in the United States.
Yeah. Yes.
And that his ability to get elected was premised on the fact that the establishment of both the Democratic and the Republican Party
mm-hmm.
had been discredited. He then mounted a challenge within the Republican Party, and he then won the leadership of the Republican Party as an outside candidate. And now, you know, now, of course, he's got more or less whoever cares to be a Republican, although people like Liz Cheney, et cetera, went the other way.
Right.
But nevertheless, the fact is that, and Trump won the election because he discovered the one thing that, that was losing people election. And that was that both the Republican and Democratic establishments were telling people the economy is doing fine. Mm. As you remember, in the last election, they were saying, oh, look at all the statistics. The economy is doing fine. Why are people so unhappy? Well, people are unhappy because they know the statistics don't capture the picture. We are hurting. We know we are hurting. Mm. We're not going to vote for you. So Trump told them that their economy is not doing well.
Yeah.
And then he said, he told them a lie because he can't really tell the whole truth. So the lie he said is that you are not doing well because of trade, because of China, because of immigrants, right? He couldn't tell them that they're not doing well because of 45 years of neoliberalism and counting, right? Mm. Which has created inequality, lost them jobs, financialized the economy, destroyed the productive structure, all of these things, okay? So he doesn't tell them that. So now he has to make a big show of imposing tariffs, of not giving money away to Europeans, and of course making peace. He knows that war is unpopular, but of course he's continuing both the wars.
Yes.
And probably many others.
While solving seven in 7 months, though, as he has said
pull
before.
Pull the other one.
No, it's so brilliant, but you're right. There is some fragmenting going on, even within the MAGA movement, because of the Israel situation, especially because of interventionalism and because of Epstein. And those three forces are making
inflation.
People
also,
in the United States
also,
turn
Richard,
away.
Their advantage or say it capacity. If there is just one country who has more chance to isolate itself is United States due to many reasons. Mm. Some of them are they have a capacity to do it. In some cases, the culturally they can do it, but the rest of the world cannot live without each other.
Yeah.
But US
yeah.
can live better than the rest of the world. So this capacity in long term will play its role. And what I see regarding the Europe, they will decide at some point.
And the next step, and one we can't get into today, but it'll be for our next conversation, is what happens with currency de-dollarization, the devaluing of the dollar, which the Chinese seem to be doing by dumping so many of the reserves or of the federal currencies. And that's happening as we speak, too. And that's the one Achilles heel that could fault perhaps your argument as to the United States being able to stand alone. But you guys are so smart and so wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
What a great conversation.
Thank you.
Three perspectives from three different parts of the world. And I thank you and our viewers thank you for sharing some of your wisdom on the side of this mountain in the middle of a cloud having this wonderful conversation. And thanks to you at home. This is the Sanchez Effect. Of course, what we're doing here all week is bringing you the show from outdoors here at this Valdai Club Summit. And as you know, my podcast is called Journalistically Speaking. We'll be putting out another edition again. I thank you for being with us. We can continue the conversation, of course, on X. 100,000 of you or so are now going to be able to make some conversations and some talking points about what you heard here as well. So we'll continue all that, and we'll see you again tomorrow. Thanks for letting us into your home, and we'll be looking for you next time.